It is from the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, as it is, which is entitled Devotional Service, text number 2. I can just do that quick, or you have 12.2. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. There yet, eh? Om Gyanati Madanasya Gyanana Salakaya Chaksurumitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Bistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Sigarau Sita Padakamalam Sigurun Vaisnavamstya Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sivisakam Vitamstya He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopesa Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vishabhana Sutta Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vansa Kalpatarubhya Chasa Kripa Sindhubhya Ivacha Patitanam Pavane Vyo Vaisnave Vyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Adaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare From chapter 12, huh? Yeah, I can't read it like this. Yep, looks like a good start. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Maya Vishya Mano Yemam Nitya Yukta Upasate Shradaya Parayupita Te me yukta tamamata Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Maya Shakta Manap Maya Vishya Mano Yemam Nitya Yukta Upasate Shradaya Parayupitas Te me yukta tamamataha. Translation. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, those who fix their minds on my personal form and are always engaged in worshipping me with great and transcendental faith are considered by me to be most perfect. Purport. In answer to Arjuna's question, Krishna clearly says that he who concentrates upon his personal form and who worships him with faith and devotion is to be considered most perfect in yoga. For one, in such Krishna consciousness there are no material activities because everything is done for Krishna. A pure devotee is constantly engaged. Sometimes he chants, sometimes he hears or reads books about Krishna, or sometimes he cooks prasadam, or goes to the marketplace to purchase something for Krishna, or sometimes he washes the temple or the dishes. Whatever he does not let a single moment pass without devoting his activities to Krishna. Such action is in full samadhi. So it is very simple, actually. If we read this verse in purport, it is such a simple verse and purport that there's nothing very complicated to derive from here. It's just as it is. We're worshipping Krishna in his personal form, and if we sometimes chant, sometimes hear, sometimes cook, sometimes serve prasadam, sometimes clean the temple, do some devotional service, then automatically we are always Krishna conscious. Because Krishna conscious can either be to meditate directly on the form or the pastimes of Lord Krishna, or it can be indirectly to look after the interest of Lord Krishna, and that is equally Krishna conscious. There is no difference. So within this world there are so many affairs that are connected to the interest of Lord Krishna. The interest of Lord Krishna is to unite the all the fallen conditioned souls with himself in an eternal loving relationship. Therefore, the Lord makes so many devices and plans, and therefore, within this world, he arranges, at least on this particular planet and on the higher planetary systems, for the glorification of his transcendental person. On the lower planetary systems, it may be more difficult at times, because there the Lord is not worshipped so easily. At least here on this planet, there is so much worship of the Lord going on. Whether it is in some perverted form or not, there is worship of the Lord. But we are getting descriptions that on the subterranean heavenly planets, there is no such worship going on, but rather that society there is totally materialistic and there's just no concept of God whatsoever. So this is certainly inconceivable to our present planet, where there's always some war being fought on the basis of some religious conviction. Therefore, religion has a great part to play in the life of people today. Of course, generally speaking, it's insane to fight wars on the basis of religious principles, because it is said that God consciousness is not meant to bring about aggression in men. So it is generally speaking, not the case that a man who becomes God conscious will take up a sword and will go and conquer the world in the name of his religion. That would be a somewhat odd manifestation of love of God. In the Bhagavad Gita, there are the Chatur Sloki, and in the first of the Chatur Sloki, which is Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo Mata Sarvam Pravartate Iti Mata Bhajante Mam Buddha Bhava Samanvita, it is explained that Lord Krishna is the source of all opulences. Everything is emanating from him, from Bhagavan. Bhagya already means all opulences. And the word van in itself is indicating that he is possessing that in full. So the Lord is the one who has all opulences, and Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo explains that further. And it says, one who knows that the Lord is the origin of all spiritual and material energies, he will render devotional service to the Supreme Lord and will surrender to him with all his heart. Buddha Bhava Samanvita. So this is the proper understanding. Prabhupada, when speaking on that verse, gave the explanation of Mugrari. He said Mugrari was a changed man, initially half killing the animal, still flapping, etc. Then later he surrendered to Narada, he gave up his bow, he broke it, he depended on Narada, so much foodstuffs came, more than he could handle. And when Narada later came to see how his disciple was doing, he was accompanied by Parvata Muni, Narada Muni's good friend. And when they came, they saw that the hunter was approaching them, but he was walking in a very strange way. He was jumping from one side to the path to the other in straight jumps. So Parvata was mentioning to Narada Muni and said, "What is your disciple doing?" Huh? And Narada said, "Let us go and see." And when they came closer, they saw the hunter and they asked him, "Why are you moving around in that strange way?" He said, "I'm trying to avoid the ants that are on the path, because I don't want to kill any of the ants."
So Prabhupada said, this is the automatic consequence of God consciousness. Automatically. Because, he said, when one loves the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then automatically one will love his entire creation and all other living entities automatically. Said if one loves the country, one will automatically love the countrymen. If one said loves the father, then will automatically love the brother. And if one loves the body, then he will automatically love the finger. So in this way, by loving the Supreme Lord, one will automatically develop affection for all living beings. In this regards, I have an experience in South Africa which comes to mind. It is a story about a famous singer. This is a lady singer who is a devotee and who performs on our Rata Yatras. She lived in a temple for some time, but that was a little difficult. But anyway, what happened to her was the following. She was a famous singer, and she made these golden records. So she had those at home, and some burglars came to steal the golden records. They knew she had many. And in the course of it, they encountered her mother, and in fear of the situation, they just killed her mother. So you can imagine what a drama. 2 days later, she came out of the house, and she met the devotees there. And they sold her a Bhagavad Gita. So upon reading the Bhagavad Gita in such a condition of life, it was exactly what she needed to kind of put her back together. I mean, she was completely destroyed. Her mother had been mercilessly killed. And then she read the Bhagavad Gita. So it was such a, it had such an impact on her that at that point she just surrendered and she decided to become a devotee. So she did. But at the same time, she's also a musician with many obligations, so she stayed a musician. Anyway, she was on the Rata Yatra, and she was explaining that without the love for Krishna, everyone hates each other on this planet. That's what she was explaining to the people. And she could, you could see here was someone who was speaking from realization, because here was someone who came from the ghetto. From not an ordinary place, but from a ghetto where life is a little different than in the nice parts of town. And she went through all this hell and had her mother mercilessly being slaughtered. So she was speaking about real hate. She could see through it all, through the polished, polite moods that people display to each other that are completely false. Oh, how nice to see you. I'm so happy you're here. Oh, God. Do come in. Welcome. False, false, false. Right. So she could see through it all the way and say, this is not genuine. Because that is the nature of material life. That in material life, if we would really reveal our hearts to each other, that would be pretty terrible. So before we start revealing our hearts completely, better we purify them a little bit, right? Because otherwise it gets too much, you know. Like, you have these, you have psychologists, psychiatrists who get paid to allow people to reveal their minds. Poor guys. Even if they pay me $1 million an hour. Well, maybe then. I wouldn't do it very quick, I can tell you that. Because it's too much. Too much. Having to take all the garbage that people have on their mind. Because this is the condition in the material existence. In the spiritual world, it is so much different. There, everyone is completely, genuinely appreciating all the other devotees. How is this possible? One might say, because in the spiritual world there is true equality on the spiritual platform, because everyone is knowing that they're all spirit souls. Yes, there's true equality, but there is also a complete difference, right? I mean, we are all here. I guess many of us are from different countries, right? And, well, you know, every country has its particular national way of doing things, right? Like the British, you know, are known to be very diplomatic with a stiff upper lip, you know. Mm-hmm. Know that a watch, right? Yes, all right, dear chap, right? And but they're not revealing their hearts so directly, you know. The French are known for a different particular quality. It is that their nose is usually pointing upwards. In this way, the various nationalities have their little traits, right? I'm not going to do them all, you know. It's like, I try to take a few nationalities that may not be represented in the room, sort of be on the safe side. But whatever it may be, I just wanted to point out just these differences out there, right? So, you know, it is quite natural amongst people that the nationalities talk about each other, right? And they go like, oh, look at the Polish, you know, and then the Russians say, oh, you know, look at these Estonians, and the, you know, the Estonians will say, the Russians have no culture, right? Things like this, you know, huh? These are normal exchanges that we have, because these differences are not artificial. They're real. They're really there, right? It's not that we just are discriminating, you know, like, and are against prejudice and all these things. No, there are genuine differences. The French are generally really walking around with their nose in the air. But still, they are very nice also. No, they're nice. At least the devotees in France are very nice. I go there regularly, and they are my friends. I like them. And the point is this, is that when we are devotees, then we can take all these differences, and we can appreciate them, and we can see how everyone, in spite of his differences, is working very hard for Krishna. And in this way, we can really appreciate. Like otherwise, me in a white body can sit in a room with a black man, and I'm going, I'm not against you, black man. Not at all. I'm very liberal. I'm completely open to any color, you know, like I don't make these distinctions, you know. I'm not on the bodily platform. But still, I know he's a black man. And I'm thinking, like, you know, I hope he's not one of these heavy black guys, you know, that like, I might think these things, right? And in my so-called liberal mood, I can try and keep up a front of equality. But it is only on the surface. Because in my heart still I sense there's a difference. There is a difference. But in devotional service, the difference may be there. But if I see that this black guy is completely dedicated in service to Krishna and works so hard for Krishna, then he moves my heart. Right? And then I really appreciate him, black and everything, for his devotional service. Right? Then I'm no longer on the artificial platform. Then I go beyond this so-called state of being liberal and open to all people, and this false kind of tolerance, you know, which we see displayed in the name of being wise and gentle and open to everyone. That's not really true appreciation, because everyone is different. Everyone has his strengths and his weaknesses. So, but if we see that everyone is engaged in devotional service, then we can develop appreciation. So this is the secret to peaceful coexistence of different communities. Otherwise, it's not possible. We cannot ignore the differences. They're there. But we appreciate it that even those gross Russians are serving Krishna like that. We are fully appreciated. And that even those who have taken birth in the lowest country in the world, just Holland, right? There's no lower country. I brought one other countryman, but he's from the higher part because he's from the south. So truly, I'm from the lowest part, just. Yes, therefore, the most degraded place, we can speak like that. And From that, therefore, I have dared to venture to say a few words about nationalities. But the principle is that truly we can only unite in devotional service. That devotees in the spiritual world, they're united in devotional service because they're so much absorbed in their active devotional service. They're so deeply absorbed in samadhi, in their service to Krishna, that it is just impressive to any other devotee to see such absorption. And therefore, he's thinking, wow, if such a devotee can serve Krishna in this way, then I must also try. Or if it is absolutely impossible, then I must assist this devotee. So in this way, spiritual relationships automatically manifest. And that is what is also required in our movement. That we are simply basing our relationship on service to Krishna. And that we appreciate each other for our service. And that is how this movement can improve. There are so many considerations, and they are also relevant. Considerations of personal needs. After all, we have to exist in this world, and we need to live in places, we need to eat, we need to dress, we need facility. And it has not always been considered. In the name of devotional service, some have felt exploited. Some have said that this is the International Society for Exploitation. Intense statements have been made. Other ones, you know, is gone, was gone, and all kinds of varieties we have heard. So, what is happening in our movement at this point in time? Well, it's a movement that is still developing. That is to say, on the surface. On the surface, this movement is very much in motion. We are watching it and we're seeing so many changes on the surface. But of course, that is important, and we could, our business is to do something about the service. If I may for a moment compare our movement to Vrindavan Dham, right? Because I was there for quite some time, and therefore I was contemplating a lot on the nature of Holy Dham. And the Holy Dham is, of course, extraordinary, because the Holy Dham looks like an ordinary Indian village. When you go there, there's typical rickshaws, you know, moving up and about, and some scooters. There are some cows walking around in the street, some pigs here and there in the road. There's lots of garbage lying around and so forth. There are shops everywhere. Please come to my shop. Like that, we are in an Indian village. Noisy, a little messy, etc. Typical. And Vrindavan looks like no other. It looks in that way similar to any other Indian village. Of course, there are temples, and it, in that way, it looks quite spiritual. So if one looks a little deeper than the surface, one begins to see already the spiritual nature of Vrindavan. But we have many times discussed that the Holy Dham is covered by a little layer of yoga maya, and that therefore one cannot truly see the spiritual nature of the Dham. And that on the surface of the Dham there is what seems to be a village in India, although in reality we are dealing with the spiritual world. So the devotees that that somehow or other have heard this and have accepted this within their hearts, they accepted that this place of Vrindavan is not an ordinary place. Therefore, whatever happens on the surface, I don't care, because I know that underneath it is the spiritual world. On the surface, oh, so many things happen. The temperature goes up to 50 degrees. Right now, 50 degrees, you know. Hot, 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 super hot, incredibly bizarre. You cannot imagine how hot. And it's all right for a day, maybe. But it goes on for a long time, and it just gradually heats your bones, you know. You just feel thoroughly heated, completely heated. And it's like you begin to dry. I have seen, I was 7 summers straight there in Vrindavan in the heat, and then I started to think, this takes too much out of me, why would I stay? I saw all these people that had gone for a few months preaching in the West come back, you know, full of energy, and they'd say to me, let's go, you know, and I was feeling, yeah, let's go, you're right. And so I was wondering, maybe I should also go. And when I did go, and when I came back, and I saw those devotees that had stayed behind, they looked like apples that had been in the oven, you know. And like an apple that's been in the oven, it's all shriveled up a little bit, like wrinkled like that. That's how they looked. They really looked like they'd been in an oven, dried up, you know, so hot. So it is very austere, very austere. Just one thing, and then after that's over, then very soon, rain, 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 and then after the rainy season, then we'll start the malaria season. Then millions of mosquitoes are stinging you everywhere, and then everyone, you see people shivering all the time, and even in hot weather you see people lying under stacks of blankets, you know, malaria is in town. And in front of the doctor's waiting rooms there are 20 people queuing up, and the doctor doesn't even take a diagnosis, he just writes recipes, malaria, 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 malaria. Just, okay, take these pills. Yes, you will be cured. So like that, this is all part of the covering. You see a devotee, you know, what's wrong with you? Oh, I have dilly belly. Oh, I have to go. Yes. Or so many other varieties of experiences are there on the surface of Vrindavan. And some people take that very serious. Very serious. They get sick and decide that's it, you know. I mean, only a week earlier, they were going to come and they were going to live in the Holy Dham. They were going to live there. They'd sold everything in their own country and they came to Vrindavan. They're ready to live there. And at the first, when the first germ gets hold of them, you know, and just manages to drive up the fever to over 40, then, and they feel like, my God, you know, I may not live, they give up that desire to spend the rest of their life in the Holy Dham and go back to their own countries. But those who are convinced that no, this is the spiritual world, right? I'm going to stay here. They're fortunate. So they stay and they take it, whatever comes. Say, well, this is Krishna's arrangement for my purification, whatever it may be, because that's what he does. He gives these things on the surface. But underneath it is the spiritual world. And if one lives in the Holy Dham in such a way, then very quickly Krishna will reveal his transcendental nature, because that is what he does in the Holy Dham. So ISKCON is exactly the same. ISKCON is an extension of the Holy Dham. Right? It is explained that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta, that he dug a channel from the spiritual world to the material world where the mercy could flow. And of course Prabhupada extended these channels and made many branches of them all over the world, so the mercy is flowing everywhere. So it's the same mercy of the spiritual world. Golokira prema dana hari nama sankirtana. The wealth of Golok is coming in this Sankirtan movement. So therefore it is the same as Vrindavan. It is, this movement is also covered by a covering of yoga maya, which is the external feature of this movement, which is there for our purification. And we're going through that. And within that, we see good and bad happening, and we're going through trials and tribulations. We are sometimes elated, and we are sometimes suffering. And in the cause of that, we burn up heaps of sinful reactions, which is very good, actually. So in this way, we cannot complain. And one who has such a spiritual outlook, yes, whatever happens in this movement, he'll see it. This is a wonderful movement. It is a blessed movement. What is this movement anyway? What is it? The International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which was founded by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada in 1966. when all the boys were sitting there in matchless gifts and during the lecture, and then after the lecture, that Prabhupada said, yes, yes, you can speak now. And this lawyer came forward and he needed some people to sign on the documents, and nobody knew what it was all about. Is that what we are now? And now so many years later, still nobody knows what it's all about. Is that the International Society for Krishna Consciousness? The one where we are wondering? Or is this movement something else? Of course, this movement is something else. Are we going to say that Narada Muni is not part of this movement? Are we going to say that Haridas Thakur is not part of our movement? That Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur is not part of our movement? That Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is not part of our movement? Of course not. They're part of our movement, more than we are. We hope to become part of the movement that they are part of, right? That's our position. So this is indeed the better understanding, that this movement is actually the movement of Lord Chaitanya and his eternal associates. We know that in the house of Srivas Thakur, every night transcendental kirtans were taking place, and so many amazing pastimes were happening there. And we know that right now in Mayapur, these things are still going on. It is not that was 500 years ago and that it has stopped since. No, these are eternal practices. The Lord is eternally performing Sankirtan in the house of Srivas Thakur. So it is mentioned in the Chaitanya Bhagavat. Therefore we can understand that this is going on right now. But can we see it? No. Most of us cannot. We may intellectually be able to conceive it. So at this point, we can maybe see only the surface of this movement, and we cannot look very deep into the nature of this movement, just as the surface of the Ganges. We can see what is there at the top, but how deep can we look? We cannot look very deep. So we have no idea about the depth of this movement and the amount of spiritual mercy and potency that is invested within it. But at least theoretically, as I'm doing this exercise right now, we can contemplate on this point sometimes. And if we do so, it will tremendously strengthen our faith in this movement. If we have this kind of a vision, then immediately we start to see, well, but it really is a very special movement. And actually the spiritual aspect of this movement is much more important than the social aspect of this movement. Although the social aspect of this movement is also there. And we have to deal with that. And dealing with it means we try to work on the social aspect of our movement, the form in which it exists in the material world, so that everything can go smoothly and that people at all stages of spiritual advancement can function within it. Those who are completely transcendental paramahansas are aloof. What do they need? We saw when it is explained how Harai Pandit, who was the father of Lord Nityananda, was always thinking of his son. And then one day this sannyasi came and he was so nice and Krishna conscious, and Harai Pandit was very pleased to receive such a sannyasi. And then after, the sannyasi asked for charity. So then Harai Pandit was ready to give him everything. And then he asked for Nityananda. Nityananda. Impossible. The first reaction was no. Right? Harai Pandit was thinking, I will never give up Nityananda. But he didn't say that. Because how could he do it? He could not say that because, not because what people would think, that he was breaking his promise. He couldn't care less what people would think. He was ready to break his promise. That was not the problem. The problem was, what would Nityananda think? What kind of example would he get if his father would break his promise? What kind of education would he give his son? What kind of moral education would he give his son? Therefore, he was obliged, in order to educate Lord Nityananda, to give his son to this sannyasi. And it said that after that, he went to such separation that he didn't eat. He didn't eat for 3 months, but nothing happened. He didn't become skinny. He didn't die. He just stayed alive. Right? He stayed alive simply by the hope that Lord Nityananda would return. Now, so transcendental devotees, they are functioning on a different level. What do they require? Maybe very little. But those who are less transcendental, they may need, for them, it is more important that they have a favorable atmosphere. It's like I had this experience that when I had a serious accident a few years ago, of course, then I had one experience which was this, is that we have our room, and in the room you have your books, you have your pictures, your tapes, and it's a nice little spot you have, you know, it's your room. And you can go there, and it's kind of a place where you can rejuvenate yourself, right? The whole day you may deal with tough things, tough situations, some heavy phone calls to make, a couple of meetings, a couple of difficult jobs to solve, a couple of agitated people to deal with, etc., etc. Whew, a hell of a day. And then, come home, relax, right? My room, you know, the pictures I like. These pictures, they kind of, they look so nice. They're very devotional. These are my favorite pictures. I like them. That's why I have them on the wall. Play a tape. This tape is really good. You know, this bhajan, it's very nice. Or just Prabhupada, so nice and soothing, you know, so transcendental. Like that. We have a little atmosphere and we can take energy from that. And I experienced that when I had this accident, suddenly I found myself in a horrible hospital room, you know, like, and cut off from all that, and there was nothing, right? And it was just cold and horrible. And in moments like this, one is experiencing how one is completely thrown back on himself. At that point, there is no more external support situation. No more temple, no more devotees, nothing is there. Just one is locked away from the world and one has to do it with Krishna consciousness for whatever is there. It is like that at the moment of death. At the moment of death, we are also alone, ultimately thrown back on ourselves with the Krishna consciousness that we have. Of course, if one is very fortunate, one may be surrounded by loving devotees who chant and scream in your ear, Haribo, 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 are you there, Haribo? Like that. Or like there was one father. He was a devotee. His wife was a devotee. His son was a devotee. And the whole family, they were all devotees. But then at the end of his life, the father was lying on his deathbed and he refused to chant. Right? So his son told the women, get out of the room. Out of the room. So they were out of the room. Then he was alone with his father and he said, and now if you don't chant, I'm going to beat the hell out of you. I'll beat you, you know, like anything. And out of fear, his father began to chant. So sometimes the mercy comes in different ways. Right? But this worked. Yes. By his merciful son, the father went back to the spiritual world because he was chanting at the end of his life. So this is great fortune. But not everyone has such great fortune. Yes, some people, they just die in the middle of nowhere. Right? In the middle of nowhere, you know, just go for a little walk in the forest and boom, you know, found the next morning. Right? Or so many cases, right? Found on floating around in a lake. Anyway, I can give, of course, many descriptions of that. And there are people who make movies of these things called Faces of Death. Right? And then you can see in these movies, you can see like 100 different ways that someone is dying, car crash, alligator, the plane, and you name it, you know. I won't get into the details of it. I'll leave it to the fertile imagination for all of you to fill it in yourself. But the point has been made that at the time of death, we might be alone in our Krishna consciousness. So therefore, we cannot just depend on the external side of this movement. Right? We cannot just say that this movement is not perfect because it's not organized perfect. We cannot say, rather we could say that this movement may not be perfect on the surface because it's not organized perfectly on the surface. But below the surface, there it is absolutely perfect. So let me go on that level. Let me just not spend too much energy looking at what is imperfect, because if you deal with the material energy anyway, with the layer on top, it's nothing but struggle. This material world, as soon as you try to do anything in the material energy, it's struggle. In this way, let us go under the surface, deeper, and look at the perfect part of this movement. And then we realize, if we thoroughly understand the perfect nature of this movement, then we realize that even the surface at the top, which looked imperfect, is perfect because it's Krishna's perfect arrangements to purify us from our imperfections. So in that way, it is entirely perfect, and there is nothing that is not perfect. But first one has to go deep into this movement before one can see that on the surface things are perfect as well. And such a person, one who is approaching it from that level, can begin to prepare for that spirit of samadhi. Because he's always looking for Krishna. And he's always connecting everything with Krishna and always seeing Krishna in everything. So then he himself becomes also Krishna conscious. In the beginning, our activities may be Krishna conscious. But how Krishna conscious are we? We are completely not Krishna conscious. We're thinking of everything, you know, like how nice it would be to go with a vacation, how nice it would be to have a lot of money and beautiful clothes and a nice house, and how nice it would be and dream and dream and dream about material things while we are engaged in devotional service. Because our activities may be Krishna conscious, but we ourselves are not yet Krishna conscious. Sometimes, but many times not. But gradually, as we go deeper into the nature of this movement and understand the tremendous mercy, it can increase our Krishna consciousness. And so that is the preparation for overcoming the conditioned stage, where we have weak faith and where we feel, I don't know about this movement. When we begin to see the spiritual nature of this movement, just like the spiritual nature of Vrindavan Dham, where one has great faith, Krishna is behind everything. This is Krishna's movement. It's not the GBC who is the controller of this movement. It is Krishna who is the controller of this movement. Right? And nobody else, right? Although we are certainly respectful to the GBC. I did not mean this as a derogative remark towards the GBC. Rather, they are acting on behalf of Krishna. But still, it is Krishna who is in control of this movement and nobody else. And therefore, whatever happens is ultimately happening with Krishna's will, and one must see it like that and take it like that. That is our philosophy. So anyhow, I guess I got my point across, and if we prepare in this mood, then we can increase our faith if we see a little deeper than the surface. And it is this faith, right, this great, great faith that somehow or other, devotional service is the most wonderful thing. It is that faith which can bring us to the state of samadhi. It is faith only. Faith is a growing thing which grows and grows and grows until one comes to the stage of love of God, then faith has fully grown. As it says here in the verse, the Supreme Personality of God had said, those who fix their mind on my personal form and are always engaged in worshipping me with great and transcendental faith are considered by me to be most perfect. So fix our mind on the personal form of Krishna, who is personally taking care of this Sankirtan movement. Any questions or comments?
You said sometimes at the beginning one is thinking of so many things, yes, maybe material desire, and maybe you meant then after it becomes purified. You didn't understand, but
yeah.
Maybe that's what you mean. Sometimes I see the opposite, the other way around. Like when one draws and one is give up everything and one is really fired up.
Yes.
And after some, not some months, some years, these, having clothes and house, these come. How can you understand that?
Because in the beginning, in our material life, we've experienced and encountered a lot of difficulties and frustration. And therefore we came to Krishna consciousness out of a motivation of frustration and material distress. We had enough, you know, enough is enough. I want to get out of this material world. So therefore we were ready to give it up, etc. But then when we engaged in spiritual life, we immediately gave up sense gratification at that point. And then we began to feel that that is austere, very austere. And simultaneously, we did not get so much transcendental taste at the same time. If I may give a little example, it's a short analogy. It's a story about people who grow up, who take birth in a oasis, and they live in the oasis and they grow up there, and it's kind of limited life. Life in an oasis was there, a few dried fruits and a few dried bananas, dates, figs, and some camel milk or something like that. What else you have there? Not much. It's austere. Then one day, if someone comes with very, very nice mangoes, everyone is amazed. They've never tasted anything like it. Alfonso Wallace, you know. So then, naturally, then the stranger who brought these fruits says, "Oh, I brought those from a land which is far away." People are saying it can't be true; he's cheating. But some people say, "No, I believe it," and they go with the stranger on the way to that land. Now, as soon as they do that, they are going on the way to the transcendental destination, but they leave the oasis of sense gratification and they go into the dry desert where lust and greed, the hot sun of lust and greed is burning on their head, and suddenly no more sense gratification. So it becomes a little tough. Yeah. So if the spiritual taste doesn't come, because we need some taste, if the spiritual taste doesn't come, then one will take again to material things, even after a long time. So that's what we see. Why doesn't the spiritual taste come? Because we make offenses. There's no other reason. The spiritual taste doesn't come as long as we make offenses. So we must be more careful. If we have no spiritual taste, then, and we follow the process and the rules, then we know that what we're doing wrong is we're making the offenses against the Holy Name. And if we can somehow or other try and avoid those, then it will improve and the taste will start coming. So this is maybe the next challenge. With these offenses, one has to think that it is something that we are like a boil full of pus personified. Right? We are offense personified. We took birth like one sinful big offense, and our whole life is offensive. It is our normal state of mind to be offensive. So it is not that we naturally, that sometimes by accident we commit one of the offenses. No, we do it all the time. That is our nature. So rather than catching ourselves that we do not sometimes make an offense, we should just break the habit and stop doing it altogether. Right? That is generally speaking our background. That's the problem. But by the process of devotional service, we can become purified from that. It gets better. Anyway, so if we become more aware of this, then we could make a more conscious attempt to conquer these offenses. Then there's, then taste will come. Then one will not, and another thing is, one must look deeper. If you look only at the surface of this, at the externals, yes, then it's blind faith. Huh? We must understand why. We must go a little deeper in spiritual life. Then we will not take again to material things. Deeper means since Krishna is behind everything, even although the front looks not so nice. Any other question?
I appreciate how the
How to appreciate?
Being naive.
Krishna consciousness is simple for the simple and complicated for the complicated. So, if one fully appreciates everything about ISKCON, I don't think that's naive. I think that's wonderful, personally. If I meet such a devotee, I fall at his feet and pray for his association that I may also develop these qualities. And that I may conquer the part in me that is looking at things about this kind of thinking, this, what about that? Because someone who sees everything as transcendental and wonderful, I think is himself transcendental and wonderful. That is the nature in that one sees according to his consciousness. So when the consciousness is perfect, one sees perfect. And when the consciousness is not perfect, he doesn't see it as perfect. Still, we may, for the sake of organization, we may want to make so many adjustments. So we may see that some people are being mistreated in our society. Yes, okay. Definitely. It is like that, you know. Sometimes we may see there is a temple president who is too strong in dealing with the devotees, who doesn't give them an opportunity to live, to breathe, to move, who controls every inch of their life, and still then it's not good enough, and, you know, and if you don't like it, then you can go, and the devotees live in complete fear and intimidation. Right, and thinking, go, but where will I go? Back to material life, how can I go? Well, somehow or other I have to tolerate this, and they suffer. Right? So one can feel that, well, somehow or other, what can we do to help such a situation? And that is true. And on one level, it would be very important to do something about that situation. On the other level, on a more transcendental level, it's still perfect, because it's all Krishna who's arranging all these sufferings anyway. And everyone is getting purified anyway in the situation. So spiritually, there is really nothing lacking in the situation. Even if your temple president beats you every day and you have to work like a donkey, it doesn't matter. If somehow or other we tolerate this till the end of our life, right, then we can go to the spiritual world. Yeah? So in that sense, from a spiritual point of view, there's nothing wrong. Still, because most of us find it hard to be donkeys, therefore we'll make some adjustments, etc. But then you have devotees who don't want to be donkeys, and that's okay, but then they'd rather be monkeys, and that is another side of a problem, right? And then they don't want to follow any rules and regulations and this, that, and just jump around from this branch to that branch and just do anything that comes in their head as monkeys do and call that spiritual life. And then they want blessings. They say, why can't I be a monkey? So this movement, when it's managed properly, it is not a movement where devotees are treated like donkeys, nor is it a movement where it is creating facility for monkeys, right? But rather
it is somewhere in between, in a balanced way. So we must consider all that. But whatever is there, if one endures the conditions, as this is the mercy of Krishna, one in that mentality becomes eligible to return back to Godhead. So there's not one temple in our movement where the conditions are lacking for going back to Godhead. In every single temple of our movement, there is all the facility to go back to Godhead. That's the bottom line. So therefore, someone who sees everything as perfect is not naive, but wonderful. So I don't think we have to be afraid to be naive. It's if you see everything as wonderful, even if you see someone who is not, maybe not behaving wonderful as wonderful, at least you're safe. You know, even if there's someone who's not so wonderful and he's not behaving wonderful, but if a naive person thinks, oh, he is wonderful, well, at least he's not making offenses. Better than the person who's looking at everyone is thinking, is he wonderful or not wonderful? Well, he's not that wonderful because I'm seeing some imperfections in him. And he also is very nice, but, you know, he's just not making it all the way yet. And they are also very good devotees. Oh, they're really good devotees. You recognize this tendency? Let's first say something really nice about, well, so-and-so, yes, they are very, very nice devotees, you know, I really want to say that. Meanwhile, rolling up the sleeves, right? the real punch is coming, you know. But, you know, I feel just that I have to say that they are totally, terribly, hopelessly, etc. And then comes something to fill it in. So we do that ourselves so many times. I do it too. Yeah, I catch myself doing it so many times and think, what good is that? So I pray to become a little more naive, like what you're talking about. It sounds wonderful.
From the preaching point of view, it will be difficult to explain it like that to people because they see more the surface, and how should they relate to that?
Yes. We preach according to time, place and circumstances. So this particular perspective which I gave now is for us, is so that we develop the faith and conviction, and that we will not become so affected by the outer trials and tribulations of this movement, but rather that we see the spiritual movement underneath. But for the world, we cannot entirely explain like that, although I think we can tell them that basically our strength is our spiritual strength. It is the strength of the devotees is in their purity. It is not necessarily in organization. So that we are not claiming to be great experts in terms of organization. There we could use a lot of help and guidance, but in terms of spiritual purity, we should not question the devotees. Even if we see that sometimes devotees are not able to maintain the high standards, etc., then that should still not be taken as that this movement is lacking purity. Rather, we should see that even those who don't succeed, that it is amazing that they even tried, right? Because the standards are so high. So it is a wonderful movement. Yeah. I think. Anyway, I cannot make a general statement how we should preach because I'm not so good at preaching into space. You know, I mean, if I have a person in front of me, then I can kind of tune my radio just at the right frequency, at least try. But if I'm speaking to the invisible man, then I'm not the best at tuning like that. But anyway, I think we can defend our movement. I think honesty in preaching is an important principle, and that we should not think that people cannot understand. I think if we honestly, in a simple way, explain that people can understand a lot more than we think they can, and that if we are dealing with them like that, that they're very appreciative. And that in fact our preaching will be more successful if we're open and honest with people. Anyway, there are, of course, situations where one must be diplomatic and etc. You know, it's like you cannot be open and honest with everyone. You cannot be naive in preaching. Preaching, you cannot be naive. Okay, any other question? Yeah, I'm fine by that. I would like to expand what you just said, our ISKCON movement, into this movement of Lord Chaitanya. Right? Because there may be some Vaishnavas outside ISKCON that are also eligible to go back to Godhead, and I do not want to diminish them in any way. But the movement of Lord Chaitanya is wonderful. It's the most amazing thing that's happening, and it's like so wonderful and so powerful, and the mercy is so great that anybody who somehow or other comes in touch with it is completely transformed, even for a moment. And anybody who stays a day in this movement, like, is permanently changed. And anybody who stays a week is very, very much changed. And anybody who stays a year, it's like his life can never be the same, nor the next. And anybody who stays many, many years, you know, like, I mean, his next life, what will it be? It's like inconceivable, the blessings that are showered upon such a person. And one who stays till the end of his life. Unlimited blessings. Unlimited. So it's wonderful. Far out moon. Amazing. How much mercy. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.